Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today we're speaking with the co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. It is February 10th, 2011. Thank you to our hundreds of listeners. We have so many options on Blog Talk Radio these days. You can friend, you can even click follow, you can get all the shows on the RSS feed, and you can upload the widget to your very own website, and that way people can see and learn about these radio shows to educate the public and create awareness about homeopathy, organic gardening, environmentalism, and your rights for vaccination, your right to have an exemption or waiver to vaccinations in the United States, and learning about the legal issues surrounding that. Join us today on the live chat, and I'll have to start that up, and ask your questions. You can favorite this show, and you can even download to your computer, your iTunes, or your iPod. I'm going to go ahead and start the chat. Hopefully, it won't start some music. If it does, just be patient with me for 1 second. Alan is on the line with us today, and I'm going to give a new introduction to him for those people who are new as listeners. So the chat is gone live right now, and I have been friends with Alan for many, many years, and I am so indebted to him for coming on the show and being part of this experience. He is one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys and advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and he speaks at so many different organizations, gives lectures throughout the United States on the issue of vaccine exemption and waiver rights. He supports legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice, and this is one of the things we're going to be talking about today. He has published internationally on vaccine health and legal matters and appears regularly at rallies, conferences, on the radio, on television, and he discusses all of these issues that people want to know and need an expert, because you have to go through this whole maze of the legal system. There's many other advocacy boards in which he participates. He's a member or a leading contributor. I could give you a list of a few of them. The Association for Vaccine Education. He co-founded the North Carolina Citizen for Healthcare Freedom. He's an associate and legal advisor to SourceForce, Inc., which is a caring ministry for poverty, AIDS, and terminal cancer victims, and an advisory council member for the Thai Healing Alliance International. Alan, you may have another organization that you want to add to this list.
Any who would like me to be involved, I'll... As you know, Debbie, I'm passionate about the vaccine issue. I stumbled onto it many years ago when my first child was born, and as I researched this to look into it for myself and to do my own assessment, I have been increasingly, ever since that time and over time, increasingly concerned about many different aspects of the vaccination, health and policy issues, and I'm passionate about the issue and about the work that I do. So I say that a little jokingly, but truly, you know, anyone who wants my support, either for a personal issue or an organizational agenda concerning vaccine rights, need only ask for it.
Right. You're very easy to get a hold of, to contact by email or however, you know, you can telephone. You're available, and I'm very appreciative of that. We're going to do something special today. You've sent me information about an issue going on in New Hampshire right at this very moment. So this is cutting-edge news. This is stuff that the newspaper should be publishing. February 10th, 2011, there is a House Bill number 416 that is concerned with adding an exemption from immunizations for conscientious beliefs. So it sounds a little bit like a for the military, conscientious observers that will not have to go into the Army when I hear that term. You have written to the senators and representatives of that state regarding this issue of adding an exemption from immunizations for conscientious beliefs and adding to those concerns raised separately by many others. And you have submitted a total, what do you call this, a proposal, a paper, what white paper, what do you call this?
I don't have a precise technical term or label for this, but in a somewhat informal sense, this is an argument, or and I would use that word in the legal sense of the word argument. This is a set of
like in a debate.
Yes, it's a series of points that are submitted for their consideration in support of the passage of this bill. Now, New Hampshire, I think, took a stab at this in the late 90s. It was unsuccessful, and the folks on this issue feel that it's time to try this again. Now, there have been attempts, both successful and failed, at getting philosophical exemptions passed. And I've come to the conclusion, and this is something, of course, we were going to be looking at here in North Carolina eventually. Right now, in the midst of working on getting amendments to the emergency health laws, and we'll come back on another show and go into that in more depth as that moves along here in North Carolina. And I have in the past and continue to be available to help people anywhere in the U.S. To the best of my ability with the passage of any vaccine rights-related legislation. But folks in New Hampshire got a hold of me just a few days ago, and that sort of sped up my timetable on this particular issue, because I've certainly had that in mind as something to work on, and so they gave me the specific current event. So they're going to be submitting information today, including information that they requested for me that I've given them. And I thought we could walk through these points today, because as I put this together for the folks in New Hampshire, of course, I knew what my conclusions were going to be generally. That is that there aren't any valid reasons not to have a conscientious exemption, and there are many powerful reasons for that. And by the way, that particular phrasing, conscientious exemption, really is just a particular wording that could be said to fall under a more general category of philosophical exemptions, just as the words exemption and waiver are largely interchangeable. There are other words, many phrases. Sometimes the philosophical exemptions are called personal exemptions or conscientious exemption. There could be several, if not many, phrases that would mean essentially the same thing. And what it boils down to is the right to say no without having to justify it for medical or religious reasons. And this is something that is sort of a point that's misunderstood by a lot of people in the alternative vaccine community. I see people over and over again make the assertion that vaccines aren't really mandatory because we have exemptions. And that is both technically and as a practical matter incorrect. The technicality is that we have mandates, and then the secondary question is, are there any exceptions to the mandate? And if so, what are they in any given state or context or situation, and do I qualify for one or more of them? And the hard reality is not everyone in our country qualifies for an exemption everywhere that vaccines are mandated. Now, there are some 20 or so states now representing over half of the U.S. population that do have philosophical exemptions. So at least with regard to routine immunizations, a good portion of our population has the ability to say no thank you without having to justify it any further than that. But that pertains to exemptions, first of all, in the context of schools, which is what most of us think of when we first think about vaccine requirements and exemptions. We're thinking about kids in school. Debbie, there are over a dozen different contexts where the question can arise, how do I legally avoid vaccines here in the U.S.? So schools are certainly a primary one, but only one of many. And within schools, there are many subsets, if you will. There are public schools, private schools, home schools, military schools, colleges, college programs where students have to do clinical work in outside healthcare institutions. All of these are categories where different laws and rights may apply. So it is true that exemptions are sometimes as easy to exercise as signing a form or even checking a box, but it is also true that many times in schools and other categories, it is not nearly so simple as that. So to reel myself back,
we want to get back to this House Bill number 416 and let people know exactly what's going on with that. And you have listed a whole bunch of points in your argument so that to inform the representatives and the senators exactly information that they have probably not heard before.
And we'll have heard directly contrary information from vaccine advocates. So let's walk through this, Deborah, and I'll tell people that we're walking through a document, as you said, that is addressed to the honorable senators and representatives of the great state of New Hampshire.
Right.
And this will be posted on my website. I have not gotten to that as of this moment, but it will be posted later today or tomorrow. It is most certainly a work in progress. That is, many, if not most, of the major research or legislative kinds of documents that I write tend to be works in progress because the vaccine issue itself is continually evolving. I keep encountering new information, and as it relates to something like this document, for example, this document, of course, as we said, is for the state of New Hampshire, but it serves, I think, as a good model or a good template for this same issue anywhere in the United States that residents and citizens would like to work toward getting a philosophical exemption passed in their state. Generally speaking, the majority of states that have philosophical exemptions are west of the Mississippi, and most of the states east of the Mississippi do not have philosophical exemptions. So, again, when we said a majority of U.S. citizens live in the 20 states that have them, there are still many of us that don't, including, of course, Debbie, you and me here in North Carolina. So the first point is, to me, one of the most fundamental points in the entire vaccine controversy, and that is the mistaken belief or the miscredited or misplaced credit given to vaccines for disease declines in the 20th century, childhood infectious disease declines. The reality is that while this varies pretty widely from specific disease to specific disease, on average, about 90% of infectious disease decline preceded vaccines. And upon realizing that, it became, you know, that's a very disturbing piece of information because of what it implies, because we are told and brought up even in just in public schools and elsewhere that if it weren't for vaccines, we would have widespread rampant disease throughout our society. And there's no question about the reality that, let's say, in the on up through the late 1800s and early to even middle 1900s, childhood infectious diseases were very serious problems. And I don't have precise figures, but you know, you could expect if you had several children that one or more of them might not survive to adulthood because of these diseases. There's no one is questioning that at least some of these diseases have been severe problems in the past. In more recent decades, I believe firmly that the threat and risk of most childhood infectious diseases is greatly exaggerated. I'll give you a real good example. I was in touch a few years ago with a British solicitor, that's the equivalent of a lawyer over in the UK, who had been researching the issue about the same time that I was, and this was before I went to law school. And he sent me copies of medical textbooks that medical students would see before and after the measles vaccine was introduced. Before the measles vaccine was introduced, measles was defined and described in medical textbooks as being a mild disease, not really a big deal. You know, rarely there will be complications. There's no 100% safe route in any of this on any side of the issue.
I have personally heard people who told stories about measles and that there were complications, whether it's deafness or something else. So, I mean, there are people who actually experienced a bad complication. I don't know exactly what the statistics are, but you're saying that you actually
it was considered to be a small percentage in the years preceding. It was considered to be, on the whole, a benign disease. You know, we can all be struck by lightning. We can all be in a fatal car wreck, and we drive every day anyway. I mean, there's no 100%. You know, the moment you are born, you are destined to die. There's, you know, the question is not how we eliminate risk of harm, but how do we minimize it? How do we best minimize it? And so, yes, there are risks everywhere with virtually everything that we do. But on the whole, just prior to the introduction of the vaccine, measles was described as being, on the whole, a benign disease. Children get it, they recover from it, they're immune, they're protected.
Did you get it? I got it. I remember all of us have it. I actually remember, I can image myself having it, and the chickenpox, obviously, most everybody had if they're a little bit older and have not gotten the vaccination for that. And it's better to get it when you're young, when your immune system is actually developing. So,
because people who get these diseases when they're older have higher complication rates.
But here's
my point. Once the vaccine was available, the medical textbooks began describing measles as something much more serious and severe. In other words, the textbooks were rewritten to support promotion and sales of the vaccines, not because somehow the vaccines mysteriously caused the disease to become more severe or virulent. And right alongside the, again, on average, about 90% of infectious disease decline preceding the vaccines, there were diseases that we never had vaccines for, such as typhoid fever, scarlet fever, tuberculosis. They declined right alongside the other diseases that had vaccines. And then there were some countries who didn't vaccinate initially, for example, with polio, when polio, other diseases were vaccinating for polio, and yet the disease declined in all of the countries. So the question about whether, you know, the sort of fundamental rock-solid presumption upon which vaccine policy is based, which is the idea that without vaccines we're going to be a disease-ridden society, that is just not true. And it gets even more disturbing than that, and polio in particular is a good example, because during 1962 congressional hearings, a Dr. Bernard Greenberg, right here from in our backyard, Debbie, from the University of North Carolina School of Public Health, he was at that time the head of the biostatistics department, testified before Congress that cases of polio increased substantially after the polio vaccines were introduced. Now, by the time the vaccines were introduced here in North Carolina and around the country generally, roughly in the mid-50s, polio had been already decreasing following the late 40s and early 50s epidemics. So polio decreased from the 20s until the late 40s. We did have polio epidemics. Nobody that I know of is questioning that reality. But it was already on a decline for a couple of years, if not a few years, by the time the vaccine was introduced. And the vaccine not only reversed that decline, a 50% increase from 1957 to 58, and an 80% increase the following year from 58 to 59, and the Public Health Service deliberately manipulated statistics to give the opposite impression. And I'll do just a real brief piece of a much larger elaboration there, but one of the things that they did was to redefine polio. Previously, conditions that are now defined and classified separately from polio, which includes aseptic meningitis, that's not the only one, but it's one of them, that following the introduction of the vaccine was recorded separately, whereas before the vaccine, those aseptic meningitis cases were considered polio. And so instantly on paper, the statistics, the polio statistics went down, and the vaccine was given credit for that. Well, it wasn't the vaccine that did that. It was changing the definition that did that. Polio reduced on paper following the vaccine, but not out in the real world. It's a very disturbing sort of thing, because that's a lie deliberately perpetrated upon the American people and the world that has been a profound part of the foundation for subsequent vaccine policy right up to the present day.
Yes, so we are really concerned about our health freedoms and using these statistics, which are, they must be authentic, coming from Dr. Bernard Greenberg, who is a statistician in public health. And why would he, he's not manipulating the information. It's the other way around, in order to provide a foundation for instituting vaccinations in public policy. They have supposedly, purposefully changed the way that diseases are labeled, or kind of done some kind of trickery with their statistics. I don't know exactly how they do it. Maybe, you know how when you look at a chart or a graph of information, you can pull out a small bit of it, and it can look one way, and then if you pull back and look at the entire spectrum, you're going to see a totally different view of what's going on with that population. Is that how they did it?
I've had some extensive conversations with a professor of medical statistics a few months ago. The quick deal about statistics is that they are treated as though they are hard data, but they are almost always pliable and often unfounded. Statistics are really, I mean, we could do a whole show talking about how that works, but the bottom line is statistics are a tool that are easy to bend and twist and mold to suit whatever, support whatever agenda you want to. The deal Dr. Greenberg, and maybe there are people who disagreed with him, but there were two states in the U.S. that actually stopped vaccinating. So certainly he wasn't the only person who saw problems with increases following the vaccine. He went on to later become dean of the School of Public Health, so he was not...
Are you talking about Dr. Greenberg or somebody else?
Dr. Greenberg. After he did these congressional hearings and presented his findings, he subsequently became, and I'm not saying in connection with these hearings, but what I'm saying is rather than, let's say, being attacked like Dr. Wakefield was and stripped of his ability to have any credibility or career in the mainstream views, this guy went on to become dean of the School of Public Health, which suggests to me that what he had to say at that time
people were listening
sound,
to him.
Was sound. Well, yeah. they were listening to him, but you know, nothing particularly happened from that insofar as again, subsequent vaccination policy proceeded as though what he revealed had never been revealed. But that's just one piece, again, of our nine-piece argument here. I'm going to encourage us to move on just so we can try
to
cover some more of these pieces.
And
again, folks, this will be posted somewhere in the next day or two on the vaccinerights.com website. I've got a whole section of the vaccinerights.com website that deals and addresses with legislative issues, documents that I've written for folks in other states in support of legislative changes needed there as well.
So right now we're up to a reliable vaccine disease risk benefit assessment is not feasible, and this kind of follows in with the statistics.
Now, we can presume legally, or more precisely legislatively, that when state legislatures have enacted vaccine mandates, they have assessed and evaluated based on the best information that they had or most credible information that they saw that vaccines are sufficiently safe and effective as to warrant and the conditions of infectious disease sufficiently risky or dangerous as to warrant mass mandatory immunizations. That implies that they've done some kind of risk-benefit assessment. And so essentially what I'm doing here is challenging the status quo in that regard. In order to do a vaccine disease risk-benefit assessment, you have to have two things. You have to know the dangers of the disease, and you have to know the dangers of the vaccines. And essentially what I'm arguing in this number two point is that we don't know either one of those. So let me give some examples. In the recent swine flu pandemic, the CDC reported laboratory-confirmed deaths here in the U.S. of both swine flu and seasonal flu, and this is for the 2009-2010 flu season, at a little over 2,100, a little over 2,100. The CDC, now that's the laboratory-confirmed deaths, or the claim, what they claim.
Is this for just the U.S.? Or is
just the U.S.
Just the U.S., not globally.
No, not globally. So a little over 2,000 in the U.S. I mean, what that really means is a separate question, but for our purposes today, let's accept that at face value.
Okay.
The CDC, however, also estimated, and anything other than that figure, a laboratory confirmed, has to be an estimate. Now, there are all kinds of statistical methods where you can get projections, extrapolations, or what have you, to come up with figures, but those are always, to one degree or another, speculative. The CDC estimates that the United States swine flu deaths, just the swine flu alone, mm-hmm. is somewhere between, and I'm using round numbers here, 8,800 and 18,000. Now, that's a really broad gap. You know, the high end there is more than twice the low end.
Right, 10,000 difference.
Yeah, there's a huge gap there.
Mm-hmm.
In stark contrast to that, Flu Tracker, which is a website called Flu Tracker, which is Ryza Labs, they estimated only 4,600 U.S. swine flu fatalities.
Uh-huh.
Now, my point here is not about who's right, what are their methods, and so forth and so on, and I'm sure there are folks who would love to dive into that on an analytical level and try to figure out who has the better estimate and so forth. But the point here is that we really don't know. We have CDC with a span of, you know, 10,000 plus or minus 10,000 in their guesses, you know, or if you add the two and divide plus or minus 5,000. But in any case, Ryza Labs' estimate is roughly half of the low end of the CDC estimate. It's reasonable to conclude from that bottom line, we don't know. But what's even more disturbing to me is, well, I mean, and so it's disturbing right off the bat. If there's any part of this equation you don't know, then you don't know the outcome. And yet we are repeatedly told over and over again that, yes, that finally authorities acknowledge there's some, you know, minuscule percentage of people who have adverse reactions, but it's, you know, that's the price we as a society pay so that everyone's protected.
We have a question.
Sure.
In the chat, the question is, when the CDC reports mortality and death, do they give the accounting of the death to the swine flu itself, or let's say the person is in a weakened state and they die, they get the flu, but they've died of pneumonia or they've died of a heart attack or something else? How is it recorded to the CDC as the cause of death?
Well, these are questions that weaken the support for vaccines even further. It's almost an endless pit in the sense that the further you look into this, the more problems you see. And I'm actually taking the argument on a fairly superficial level deliberately with regard to state legislatures because, as a practical matter, if you can make a concise argument, a focused, clear, concise argument, minimal but certainly sufficient support, you've got something that there's a better chance they're going to be able to hear, they're going to be able to internalize, they're going to be able to accept, and they're going to be able to act more easily on what you're saying. But let me address that question because it's quite a valid question. that, you know, how do we count flu deaths? And it's my understanding that a majority of flu-related deaths, swine flu or otherwise, the people don't actually die directly from the flu, but they die from some complication, and that's often pneumonia. And there was just a study coming out of Korea that shows a strong correlation between pneumonia deaths and antacids, which I thought was real interesting, which are
and antacids?
Antacids, which are actually given and often given in the hospital. And so, you know, there is a legitimate question to, you know, that can be asked, how many of these flu deaths are even flu deaths, you know, depending on how you define that, and are there possibly other factors?
Normally the people who are dying from getting the flu are the elderly who are weakened, or people who already have an immune dysfunction, people who are predisposed to respiratory illness, children with asthma, very young. And amazingly, they're finding that the population who are susceptible to these pandemics are young, healthy individuals. So that is because they have not built up their natural immune system. For instance, the 1970s or other kinds of epidemics that swept through the country, if you got sick, you built up a natural lifetime immunity, where when you do these vaccinations, you have to continuously do boosters. And very often when you get the vaccination, you have a huge immune response, a forced immune response that puts you into the state of having the flu anyway. It's something that you want not to get, and you end up with it. So it's kind of controversial in that way.
And I tell you, there's so many different important tangents here that we could go off on. I hear in my practice I've spoken with many nurses and other hospital and healthcare employees in recent months as hospitals have been implementing new flu vaccine requirements. And I hear over and over again, anecdotally, that, you know, I've been working for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. I've never had a vaccine. I don't ever get the flu. The nurses who get the shot are the ones who end up taking sick days off because they get the flu. And it seems sort of like this vicious cycle. They get the shot because they get sick, and yet somehow it seems not to affect that. I dropped my car off yesterday to get it inspected, waited a few minutes on it, and couldn't have been there more than 5 minutes, and heard one of the workers there on the phone telling someone, yeah, I got the flu shot, and then I got the flu.
Right. And we don't have the statistics for this, but you're going to hear a lot of stories. And these are one of the reasons why people decide afterwards, once they've had the flu shot, whether they were allergic to the albumin in it or the aluminum or whatever, that thimerosal, whatever happened in it, they got a bad reaction. They said, I'm not going to do that again. So let's continue on. Otherwise, we're not going to hit any of these points here. We know
yeah,
that
I
even
think we're already
less...
looking at two shows to cover this, Debbie.
let's see how we're doing. We know less about the scope and severity of vaccine injury and death, is exactly what we've been discussing, and the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS, and the National Vaccine Injury and Compensation Program, NVICP, have revealed irrefutably that vaccines cause permanent injuries and death, but they are inadequate measures of the scope of the problem. And we know that we don't have enough people reporting these vaccine injuries. So,
right. You know, the NVIC did a survey, the National Vaccine Information Center, a nonprofit organization that advocates for people injured by vaccines and for vaccine freedom of choice, informed choice. They did a survey several years ago of New York pediatricians, and only 2.5% of them said that they report vaccine injuries. There was even some congressional testimony a few years ago that medical students are taught in medical school not to report vaccine injuries. They are required by law to do so. But I tell you, when I was in law school, I was looking this up, so I can't say what the laws are necessarily currently, but that time I could not find, I found that there was a law requiring doctors to report vaccine injuries. What I could not find was any law that set out any sort of penalty or punishment for not doing so.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose if you knew of a doctor who didn't report an injury, you could write a you could make a complaint to their state medical board because there's federal and probably state laws as well, but in any event, federal laws requires that.
We could probably have a whole show surrounding this particular issue about reporting vaccine injury because it is such a amorphous type of a issue where we don't have enough facts around it, whether it, the person has to report something that occurred within the first 7 days, 10 days, or even 6 months later. It could we attribute some sort of a side effect to the vaccination or even years later. And this is really very controversial. So let's continue on.
Sure, but here's the bottom line is that we know because of the injury compensation program and the adverse event reporting system that vaccines can and do cause permanent injuries and deaths. What we don't know is what the scope of that is. Even the FDA and the CDC have acknowledged in the past that reported adverse drug events represent as few as 1 to 10% of the events actually occurring. And former FDA Commissioner David Kessler has even been quoted as saying that the actual events or reported events may be even less than 1% of events actually occurring. So, and it's even worse than that. And this was a wonderful piece by,
We also have, I mean, we can make generalizations, and somewhat Dr. Bob in the live chat today is telling us that statistics are being fudged, and you know, fudge is kind of like a general word. It's not specific. Like, we should have information about how data can be manipulated. What is it that can be done that appears to be factual and yet is an alternate reality just to create a perspective that is biased from the person. I mean, we as advocates for exemptions and freedoms, they might say we're doing the same thing, but I don't know. How do we get our data out
there? Well, the problem, I think, inherently, and this is only the top layer of a deep subject, is that statistics are treated as though they are rock solid and hard, whereas statistics inherently are something less than that in the best case, in the best kind of data and statistics that are derived from that. But it's sort of like, to use an analogy, people can do when people do, let's say, market sampling and they send out a survey or something, they can frame questions in such a way as to predispose the outcome to be something that serves a preconceived agenda as opposed to something being completely neutral and objective. And statistics can be manipulated in a similar way. You can collect data, you can ask for it to be reported in such a way that it will enable you to support whatever case you want to make. But here's the response, though, because the question of can people on both sides or any sides of an issue do that as a starting place, absolutely yes. Here's the problem that all of that leads to, or the conclusion I draw from that kind of thing. For purposes of rights, for purposes of asking state and federal legislators to give us rights to make informed choices, we don't have to so much show that the other information is flat out wrong as we do that there is a legitimate controversy.
Right.
And the argument then the argument becomes, is it up to the government to decide that for us, or given the legitimate dispute, the legitimate controversy, shouldn't we be the ones deciding that with the healthcare professionals of our choosing? And or even on our own if we so choose not to consult healthcare professionals. So while ultimately I am hopeful that the truth about vaccines will emerge into the mainstream, over the short term, those of us who do believe there are serious problems need to become legislatively active as a way of turning those concerns and the truths and realities as we perceive them into meaningful rights, the ability for us to say no and to choose, as you know Debbie, as a homeopath, among the more effective, less costly, and safer alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
But the bottom line is we don't know the two key things that are necessary to make a reliable vaccine disease risk benefit assessment. You know, is it a positive net benefit? Well, we don't know. We don't have reliable, precise mortality data, and we don't have from the disease, and we don't have reliable, precise information about the adverse effects, which also includes deaths, about the vaccines. Given that, is it really appropriate for government to decide, well, they probably are safer and effective, and of course, you know, the support for that is the previous point. Well, look, we don't have any disease now. Of course, vaccines work. Well, that's not
right.
how we got here. So, you know, that falls apart under scrutiny.
These are all very, very good points. So the belief that the unvaccinated person – oh, that's the next thing. So
Sure. Let's move right on.
We want to move along. The belief that the unvaccinated person poses a risk of harm to others is without merit. And this is the herd immunity controversy or concept?
Well, there's a couple of different points here, and I'll be there's sort of the broader general issue point, which is ludicrous, really, when you look at it. But then there is a more subtle or more specific concern that is a more intelligent question at the very least. So I'll break it down into two parts. So the first kind of broad sweep is that if vaccines work, then of course unvaccinated people have no reason to be concerned. Vaccinated persons have no reason to be concerned about unvaccinated people. We hear over and over again from the pro-vaccine community that these terrible, awful people who claim a religious exemption or philosophical exemption who are deliberately unvaccinated are putting themselves and everybody else at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's two problems with that. One is that not being vaccinated does not somehow magically convert you to a disease magnet. We're fortunate in the U.S.
Disease magnet.
Well, but that's the belief. There's two parts to this. One, that if you're not vaccinated, you're a disease magnet. In places where disease has not been around for decades, you will suddenly somehow manifest a disease, pull it up out of the ground or out of the air or out of trees or somewhere, and spread it to everyone else. So that's the first part. If you're not vaccinated, you're a disease magnet. And the second part is that if you're not vaccinated, somehow everybody else's vaccines, the people who were vaccinated, their vaccines all of a sudden don't work. I mean, those are the two things that have to be true if being unvaccinated is going to cause a problem for the rest of the community who is vaccinated. So, you know, when I frame it that way, it looks rather silly. But we keep hearing again over and over again that unvaccinated people are putting everyone else at risk. Now, here, the issue isn't resolved that simply, though, because there is a more legitimate concern. It's ultimately misplaced, in my opinion, and I'll explain it. But there is a more legitimate concern that has come up, and I know people who have tried. There were people, I think, in Vermont in the last year or so tried to get a philosophical exemption passed, and they were unsuccessful with it. And this was part of the reason, is that there was a medical person saying, well, you know, there's a small percentage of people who would like to be vaccinated but who can't for medical reasons. And those people are unprotected. They don't get vaccines. And so when other people willingly forego vaccinations, they put these other people at risk. And let's face it, when pressed, the medical community will acknowledge, or anybody with integrity in there will acknowledge, that vaccines are not 100% effective. Now, that assumes you define effectiveness by the generation of vaccine-induced antibodies. There's a whole separate question about, because the vaccines that the antibodies that are produced by vaccines are not the same as those produced by the wild disease. So there's a whole separate question about whether that really constitutes immunity. But we'll assume for purposes of the legislative case that we're making in this document that when the vaccines work, that is, produce the antibodies, that maybe there is some beneficial effect there. There is some protective effect. But with that as the measure, the medical community knows and will acknowledge if pressed that vaccines are not effective in everybody. That is, there will be some percentage of people, it's going to vary from vaccine to vaccine, But some percentage of people who just don't have the antibody-generating response that the vaccine is intended to induce. So here's the bottom line. Even if we vaccinated everybody we could except the people who are not medically fit subjects for vaccination, there would be those medically exempt people and then some percentage of the others who got vaccines who were not protected as defined by the vaccine causing the production of antibodies. And so people who add to that unprotected group by deliberately refusing vaccines are a risk to those who really want to have the vaccine protection but don't or can't. Mm-hmm. And so, this belief is based on the herd immunity theory that says that as long as most people in a population are immune, the entire population is protected. But the problem is that if we have too many people who aren't protected, who are unvaccinated or whose vaccines don't work, if that total population gets sufficiently large, then all of a sudden we don't have the herd immunity effect, and more people are going to get sick, especially those poor people who wanted to be vaccinated but couldn't. The problem with that, and so it's a little more involved, and it's a little bit more of a legitimate or sophisticated level of concern than just the sweeping, if vaccines work, then why are you worried about my unvaccinated child? Yours has the vaccine. She's protected. Who cares? You know, why do you care about my kid being unvaccinated? But it isn't really that simple. The problem, though, as I said, that this is based on the herd immunity theory, and the herd immunity theory has been substantially disproved. There are documented cases in the medical literature of measles, mumps, smallpox, pertussis, polio, HIV. Outbreaks of all these different infectious diseases have occurred in highly vaccinated populations. And it goes even farther than that. It's not just that. There was actually a study looking at outbreaks of measles in the 1980s that occurred around the country in highly vaccinated populations. The CDC even documented one outbreak in a 100% vaccinated population.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's not 100% protective, and you have statistics to back that up. And this is the information that the representatives need to see, that, you know, and if they have to have it in their face, because they could brush it aside. They have so many papers that they're reading. Somebody needs to actually be a spokesperson and tell them and actually hold their face and look at them and tell them, these are the facts. You're getting you're getting other information from one side of the aisle, and you need to be listening to this side of the aisle, because this message is not being heard. And by you presenting this paper to them, perhaps they will get it. But they need to have a lot more people to speak up about it. Now, we are very, very fortunate that there is somebody named Mark in the chat room who lives in North New Hampshire and is really concerned about this issue, because this is his state's issue, this House Bill 416. And, you know, he can – we'll put you guys together so that you can talk more about it. He's actually on the line. Is it okay, Alan, let him in? Okay,
please
hello,
do.
Mark. Mark,
hello.
Welcome to our show.
Love, light, and blessings. Yeah, I mean, this information is so important because the drug companies and the medical establishment needs to be held accountable. And the big thing, as you both know, is the drug companies put a lot of money into the medical schools for wings in their hospitals and yada, yada, yada. So they have an awful lot of influence on the actual education the doctors get, which is pretty sad.
Yeah, and a lot of the arguments that that we'll get to later in this document that talk about some of the conflicts of interest, some of the problems, broader problems in with the credibility or lack thereof of medical research generally, and the problems with the, for example, criminal behavior in the pharmaceutical industry. These are all parts of the underlying issue. But, you know, there's several pieces in sort of the broad sweep of the legislative initiative. Of course, we are approaching this as idealists. We want to have disclosure, full disclosure, and transparency. We want the truth about what really goes on to emerge. Now, you may present this to a legislator and be lucky enough to find one who is able to hear what you're saying. That's not going to happen with every legislator. But even if you do, there's then the practical reality of politics.
Right.
You know, just because they hear you and even quietly agree with you, you know, can they, are they in a political environment where they feel that they can, you know, endorse and support it? So, and
right.
I feel horrible even, you know, having to acknowledge that, that reality, that side of politics. You know, we want so desperately, those of us on the this side of the issue want so desperately for things to function in a more idealistic way. You know, let's find out what the truth is, let's act on that.
Right.
And eventually, of course, that's what we must continually push for until it happens. I'm not saying that that's, you know, not an option. But what I am saying is that, for example, in talking with someone from New Hampshire just last night, they were saying previously a bill had come up, they had enough people to support it, and then somebody in a caucus decided that all the people in their party had to vote a certain way, and they lost the votes that they had. And it was a purely political sort of manipulation and maneuvering. And so I guess my point is that we have those realities to deal with as well.
Right.
It's not
just
about bringing the information to the forefront, but of course we have to start with the information and then you know, look for their support back to us and our issue on how to move this through the system.
Right. Now, Alan, also myself working as a nursing assistant, and I really don't like really working in the field, especially in facilities, like nursing homes, for example, because I've seen in one particular nursing home I was working in for a little while where there was a centurion. I think the patient was 103 years old, and, you know, she was fairly healthy. Of course, not perfect, obviously, but mentally she was pretty healthy, more or less, for her age. And as soon as she started eating the foods that they serve and taking the medications that they were giving her, her condition declined, you know, over a few weeks, you know, a short period of time. And it was very sad to see that happen. And I knew, you know, because I'm also a healer, you know, intuitive, that it was because of the foods and the drugs.
I have shifted myself from a mainstream allopathic upbringing, if you will, you know, everything done the conventional medical route, from my childhood to in my adulthood being appreciative and having accessed a just really broad range of everything from allopathic to the more obscure alternatives. And I find myself at this point philosophically in a place where I think those healing modalities that acknowledge and address the energetic levels are the ones that are most promising, because
yes,
they recognize both wholly and fully who and what we are. And so delighted to hear about the work that you do. Just delighted.
Yeah. You, I mean, if you're interested, actually, you know, both you and Deb are welcome to come on one of my blog talk shows, and we can talk about this in length. You know, I can talk to you on air to set up what we're going to talk about on the show.
Well, please contact us afterwards, and we'd certainly be glad to follow up with you on that.
I already sent Deb an email, so
right, we're connected, and we're going to talk about it. So we only have a short number of, we have about 5 minutes left in the show, and out of a 10-page paper, we have reached maybe 1.5 pages. So
the last 2 pages, to be fair, the last 2 pages are all footnotes. So. But let me see if I can do sort of a begin to do kind of a wrap up of what we've talked about today and where we're going, and Debbie, if it with your permission, we can maybe pick this up next week. I think listeners know, but let's remind them that this is a weekly show at the same time every week, and we always welcome your questions and input and contributions. And the first Thursday of every month, we have attorney Greg Glaser on, talking with us about a more precise subset of the larger vaccine rights issue, and that is about our rights and how they change when there is a declared emergency or martial law would be declared, pandemics and that sort of thing. Because, as I've mentioned before, Debbie, and as I found out during the recent swine flu pandemic, and I started getting phone calls from people all over the country saying, hey, if they mandate this swine flu vaccine, how do I get out of it? And what I realized as I began looking into that question is that actually there may not be any way you can get out of it insofar as most states have laws that allow the state to throw exemptions out the window if they declare an emergency. And most of them have quarantine laws that allow them to quarantine you if you're not vaccinated in a declared emergency, if you refuse vaccines, and they get to decide the location. So a lot of us
he's helping us. So on the first Thursday of each month, Greg Glazer is helping guide through constitutional law and his perspective based on the paper that he wrote. And then the following weeks in the month, it's Alan and myself and any other guests that come on, and we talk about just exemptions and waivers, the whole maze that people of different varying situations and circumstances have to deal with. And Alan is always telling us the latest news, how we can get legislatively involved in action items like we are doing today, plus what happens in his office. And I'm looking forward to the show when he tells us the kinds of questions that he gets on a weekly basis. So today, let's just close with what we've been talking about and remind people that Alan does have an ebook, which is very descriptive about all of these issues and can answer many, many questions that people have. Alan, today has been talking specifically about this New Hampshire bill, House Bill 416, concerning the exemption from immunizations for the conscientious beliefs, and adding to those concerns raised separately by others, he has given us point-by-point paper dealing with his argument in a legal sense to this debate, and bringing it up to the House representatives and senators so that they have the other side of this issue and they're not just bombarded with only the pro-vaccine agenda.
And Debbie, I would like to add that some of these we've gotten through three of nine different points or arguments here. Some of these, I think, stand well on their own, stand alone. But some of these, I think, either separate from that or along with that, really interact, require consideration with other points to really appreciate the full impact of the argument. So when we get to the very end, and the document has a series of conclusions, when we get to the very end in the next show or whichever show we reach the end on this, we'll go over those conclusions. And I think what folks will see is not only the strength of the individual arguments, but that taken together, they are quite compelling. And I will be repeatedly arguing throughout this paper and in the conclusions at the end that not only is there justification for conscientious exemption, given the realities, given the facts, that state legislatures really are morally and ethically compelled to allow this option. And it certainly is my hope that we'll be able to convince the legislators in New Hampshire and other states of this as we move forward on this particular agenda of getting philosophical exemptions in all of the states.
That is perfect. And we're just going to go ahead to our close. And we will see you next Thursday. I'm looking forward to continuing this line of discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate. Walk by walk, we are reaching.
allow our souls to shine. Reaching for the greater love and hearing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be your soul. What I want, we are changing the world. Your truth be young girl.